Good afternoon, and an Eid Mubarak to our Muslim friends. It is a pleasure to welcome you all here to talk about Iran meeting the military challenge. To talk today, I'm really pleased. I mean, often I'm pleased, but I can't remember a time I've been so pleased. And part of the reason I'm so pleased is because our speakers today bring together somebody who I've had tremendous respect for a long time and have known for a long time, and somebody who I've only known by reputation and now finally have a chance to meet. Fred Wary, I know because for several years people have been telling me, you really need to meet Fred Wary. Fred is at RAND, has been doing a lot of work on Gulf security issues. He is a reserve officer in the Air Force and serves currently every year in the region, has done a lot of work on regional responses to the Iran nuclear issue, and has written a whole bunch of very, very interesting work on Middle East issues in general. He got his master's degree at Princeton, his BA in history from Occidental College, and everybody tells me that Fred is somebody you have to watch if you're going to know anything about where Americans think the Middle East is going. He is speaking with my old friend Michael Eisenstadt. I met Mike when I came to Washington 10 years ago. He's been not only a friend and a colleague, but Mike is, I think, unusual in Washington in that he really only tells you what he knows. And
it'll be a 2-minute talk, so
Most people in Washington sort of know 3% and then make up the other 97, present company accepted, of course. Mike said, you know, I really want to give this thought several days, and I've got this coming up and that coming up. Can we defer the talk a little bit? I mean, Mike is really a serious, serious analyst. Not only has he worked at the Washington Institute, he's in the U.S. Army Reserve doing military intelligence, has worked extensively on Iraq, but all sorts of regional military issues. Mike is I think, a remarkably solid analyst and is a serious analyst and I think gives analysts all a good name. So I'm really delighted to have the two of you here. I think we're all going to benefit tremendously from you. We're going to start with Fred and then go on to Mike, and then we'll open up the floor to discussions. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, John, for the warm welcome, and thank you all for taking time out of your busy schedules to come discuss this important issue. Our topic today is defining or meeting the military challenge from Iran. One of our first tasks, therefore, is to define the character of this challenge, and this is exceedingly difficult given the multidimensional nature of the threat that Iran poses, as well as the enigmatic nature of the state, and the fact that Iran frequently exaggerates and obfuscates its military capabilities. Nonetheless, let me start out by focusing on three broad themes that inform Iranian strategic culture: deterrence, strategic ambiguity, and strategic patience. Then I'm going to drill down into how these concepts or precepts have really informed Iran's emerging doctrine and its concepts of operations. Here we're talking about asymmetric warfare, its larger support to terrorist groups and paramilitaries, as well as concepts for homeland defense, such as mosaic defense and spontaneous battle. And of critical importance, I think, is understanding how well Iran's military capabilities have actually trained, equipped, and organized to meet these very lofty doctrinal aspirations. And then I'm going to conclude very briefly with how Iran's neighbors in the region perceive the threat from Iran. This is very important given the diversity of perception. And I'm going to argue, and we can discuss it at the end, that managing these diverse perceptions and diverse reactions may actually be more of a daunting challenge than the challenge from Iran itself. The issue of the threat from Iran has opened up extensive fissures both between Arab regimes and their publics, as well as among Arab regimes in the region. So what emerges from these observations, therefore, are certain gaps, I think. Gaps between Iran's conventional military and its aspirations for asymmetric warfare. Gaps between the expectations that Iran has of its regional allies, its proxy groups, so-called proxy groups, terrorists, and how those groups perceive Iranian patronage, and then also gaps, I think, between, as I mentioned, between Arab regimes and their publics in terms of how the Iranian threat is perceived. So starting out with some key strategic concepts that inform Iran's behavior. Deterrence. This is really the centerpiece. It informs Iran's broader political military strategy in the region. Much of its bellicose posturing through military exercises is a form of strategic communications to the region. A 1998 Journal of Defense Policy article defined deterrence as, quote, having a psychological impact on the enemy and preventing him from planning an assault or starting a war. So it really has a psychological dimension. More tangibly, deterrence is reflected, I think, in Iran's drive for an indigenous enrichment capability and a possible breakout capability, its buildup of intermediate-range ballistic missiles, and even its reliance on asymmetric warfare, such as support to terrorist groups and proxies, paramilitaries. Importantly, this last option, support for terrorist groups and paramilitaries, is framed in Iranian defense doctrine as having a deterrence function. It's not so much trying to overturn the regional order or project Iranian hegemony. Rather, it's viewed as sort of an extended form of homeland defense. If we look at a 2001 IRGC strategy document, they talk about a doctrine of peripheral defense, quote, peripheral defense, or a doctrine of extremities. In other words, utilizing Iran's allies of the revolution in Iran's near abroad and also globally to affect a potential adversary's calculations about his own safety and security before he contemplates aggression against the Islamic Republic. We see this doctrine continued by 2005 in IRGC writings and speeches, echoing this deterrence function of supporting terrorist groups and paramilitaries, but with a more confident tone. Indeed, many of these speeches argue that the U.S. presence in the region, in Iraq and Afghanistan and the Gulf, far from actually encircling Iran, actually presents Iran with certain attractive vulnerabilities to exploit via proxy attacks. A critical feature of this deterrence function, I think, is the element of uncertainty. The fact that in an adversary's mind, he can never be sure of when the attack will come. And this leads to the second major concept that I'm going to talk about, and that's strategic ambiguity. When we look at Iranian exercises, when we look at Iranian announcement of new weapon system, it's frequently characterized by great degree of exaggeration, claims of fantastic and unprecedented capabilities. According to an interview with a conservative commentator for Resalat in 2005, he says, quote, we should not hastily reveal our military capabilities. In fact, this lack of clarity regarding the consequences of military attack is one of the factors that can deter Washington. So again, strategic ambiguity having a psychological impact in terms of deterrence. Now, should these concepts of deterrence and strategic ambiguity fail and conflict results, Tehran will resort to the doctrine of strategic patience. This is the belief, and I think it's really rooted in Iran's 8-year war with Iraq, that superior morale and ideological fortitude will be critical in outlasting a better-equipped adversary. But this also really stems from Iran's observations of recent conflicts, most notably the experience of the Lebanese Hezbollah, both throughout the 1990s and in 2006, and the ongoing Iraqi insurgency. It's important to note, however, that this emphasis on indoctrination, superior morale, ideological fortitude, as it is reflected in Iranian training and exercises, could present certain opportunity costs in terms of what sort of battlefield efficacy you're actually equipping your forces with. Now, all of these tenets, deterrence, strategic ambiguity, strategic patience, manifest themselves in Iran's declared shift toward asymmetric warfare. And this is a term that they use in has a very elastic and unclear meaning. In general, this warfighting doctrine of asymmetric warfare aims to avoid a direct and protracted engagement with the U.S., while at the same time forcing a protracted struggle such that the costs are intolerable for the U.S. and its regional allies. Tehran appears to have applied its asymmetric warfare concepts to many facets of its defense strategy. focusing specifically on four concepts of operations: impeding regional access for foreign U.S. forces, inhibiting the export of energy resources, conducting warfare by proxy in various zones of retaliation, Afghanistan, the Gulf, and Iraq, and lastly, should an invasion occur, defending the homeland in depth via popular resistance and partisan warfare. I'm going to focus very briefly on number one, impeding regional access, and number four, defending the homeland. Now, although Iran would hope to have a direct effect on the flow and operations of U.S. forces themselves into the region, I think one of its principal goals is to convince regional governments that are hosting U.S. forces or tacitly supporting them that the cost of incurring Iran's wrath would greatly outweigh any benefits of siding with the U.S. And one obvious means to do this is ballistic missiles. Again, stemming from the legacy of the Iran-Iraq War, Iranian leaders appear convinced that these weapons are the most reliable means to attack deep targets, that they have a psychological impact on the enemy's morale, on the enemy's calculations, that is disproportionate to their actual destructive power. Iran would likely therefore threaten regional states, population centers, energy infrastructure with ballistic missile attacks if they allowed U.S. aircraft based there. Iran may be able to salvo these missiles, possibly overwhelming air defenses while making it difficult to target mobile launchers. We see this in various exercises, such as the Great Prophet 2 exercise in 2005, where they reportedly claimed that they could salvo Shahab missiles. However, without improvements in payload and accuracy, these missiles actually have a military value that is fairly modest. Nonetheless, they're a very highly visible retaliation option that may have great appeal within the context of Iranian factional politics. In other words, satisfying the urge, the immediate urge within Iranian leadership circles to do something in response to U.S. aggression. Aside from ballistic missiles, there's also the option of commando raids by a small craft on littorals or clandestine insertion, sabotaging facilities critical to deployment and energy export. And as I noted before, there's also the option of so-called proxy retaliation via Iran's terrorist allies or paramilitary allies in the region. This needs to be caveated. I think it's sort of conventional wisdom to sort of inflate this. While undoubtedly there are sleeper cells, there are fringe groups beholden to Tehran, many traditional Iranian allies will probably carefully weigh the risks and benefits to their own domestic agendas before they take a provocative action solely in the service of Tehran. In other words, the notion that there are certain traditional Iranian, quote, clients that will willingly act as its retaliatory agents in the event of a conflict needs to be caveated and needs to be re-examined. I think this is particularly true for many Gulf-based Shiite groups who have achieved various degrees of political integration since the post-revolutionary turbulence of the 1980s. They're unlikely to jeopardize this progress by taking any steps purely in the service of Iran that would allow their respective regimes to clamp down and retract on this progress. And finally, in terms of regional impeding regional access, Iran's most worrisome capabilities include its naval maritime capabilities, its ability to impede, if not completely deny, maritime access through the Strait of Hormuz. Again, this is learning from the losses of its conventional forces during the Iran-Iraq War at the hands of the U.S. Navy. They've been fairly successful in evolving many of their naval capabilities toward an asymmetric doctrine involving so-called swarming tactics, small, fast attack craft that could overwhelm a ship's defenses, and equipping much of their fleet with mine-laying capabilities. Now, shifting now briefly to homeland defense, Iran has also applied asymmetric concepts to its strategies of popular mobilization of the homeland, defense of the homeland via partisan warfare. Again, the end state here is to convey the ability to inflict exorbitant costs upon an invader as a deterrent, and should an invasion occur, to draw out the campaign to the extent that the invader loses his mettle to pursue his objectives. Supporting these objectives are concepts fairly innovative and creative concepts such as mosaic defense and spontaneous battle.
Under the Mosaic defense concept, partisan and irregular units comprised principally of mobilized Basiji auxiliaries would fall back behind an advancing army, harass his lines of communication. More specifically, exercise activity suggests that Mosaic defense doctrine would entail exploiting Iran's ability to sustain massive casualties, as well as canalizing an invading army's advance into terrain that favors the defenders. We also see in exercises various tactics supporting this doctrine, such as anti-hellebore operations, the creative use of anti-tank tactics by motorcycle-borne units. This makes for very compelling theatrics, but its actual efficacy remains unknown. The critical question, I think, is understanding how much progress Iran has actually made in structuring, training, and equipping its forces to meet these lofty ambitions for asymmetric warfare. Iran appears to be pursuing five imperatives to equip its forces to do this. The first is building ideological fortitude in the ranks of its military forces and its citizenry. The second is attaining self-sufficiency in arms production, again, a lesson from the Iran-Iraq War. The third is enhancing joint force integration among the different service components, but also between the Artesh and the IRGC. The fourth is incorporating modern surveillance, C2, and mobility. And the fifth, promoting initiative among its field officers. Without going into too much depth, on each one of these fronts, Iran's progress has been marked by significant shortcomings and limitations, with the possible exception, I think, of number five, where Iranian doctrine has been very successful in devolving tactical authority down to the lowest levels. Iranian planners appear convinced that their strategy of homeland defense will essentially be a captain's war fought at the lowest tactical level, and Iranian military exercises appear to reflect that. Now, taken in tandem with the level of Iran's military spending compared to other regional actors in the region, these significant gaps between Iran's doctrinal ambitions and its own fairly modest conventional capabilities, I think have important implications for regional strategy and the viability of security assistance to local U.S. partners in the Gulf. Now, certainly these states fear attack from Iran. They fear ballistic missile retaliation. There's considerable pessimism in the region about TBMD. They fear commando raids, proxy retaliation, the disruption of maritime traffic through the Strait of Hormuz. But I think there's also a more acute form of fear of Iran's soft power projection capabilities. In other words, its ability to speak over the head of Arab rulers, to mobilize sympathy among Arab publics by portraying Arab rulers as lackeys of Washington and Iran as a populist challenger to the status quo, and on the nuclear issue, a beleaguered victim of Western doubled standards. And I think this dynamic would certainly come into play in the event of a conflict in which Iran would certainly try to pressure Arab regimes that are hosting or supporting U.S. forces by appealing to the public sphere. So that's an important dimension of understanding this challenge, whether we define it as a military challenge or the challenge writ large. Now, aside from the regime-public divide, the threat from Iran has also opened up intense debates among the Arab states themselves. It's thrown into question old security paradigms and power hierarchies, as well as traditional relations with outside powers. And arguably, and this is a topic for our discussion, I think arguably managing these diverse perceptions among the U.S.'s Gulf allies and the reactions of local states to this multidimensional threat may be actually more of a daunting challenge than the actual military challenge from Iran itself.
Thank you. There's a lot to think about there. Mike, please give us more to think about.
Thanks, John. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here, and a delight to be on the panel with Fred. What I'm going to do is talk about American policy in dealing with the challenges posed by Iran's military capabilities, in particular focusing, as I think has been the main focus of American policy the last few years, on nuclear diplomacy and the challenges of nuclear deterrence, and then looking at also the challenges of dealing with the conventional military challenges posed by Iran's military based on the assumption that one of the things that Iran is trying to accomplish by developing a nuclear option is perhaps gaining greater freedom of action for its conventional military forces. So any deterrent framework or that we're trying that we would want to try to create with our allies in the Gulf would not only look at deterring nuclear weapons use, but also deterring Iran's ability to use its conventional military capabilities under the nuclear umbrella. First, I just want to just make a few comments with regard to where things stand with sanctions, because that is the main thrust of American policy now for dealing with Iran's nuclear program. And I think it's for reasons that I think will be clear in the course of my presentation, I think there's widespread agreement that this is, for a number of reasons, this is where our main efforts should continue to lie, at least for the foreseeable future, and the main hopes for success rest. And basically, we're pursuing sanctions diplomacy on three tracks: the UN, with the EU, and then on bilateral basis with various countries in the EU and elsewhere. First, with regard to the UN, we already have two UN resolutions, 1737 and 1747, which really, if you look at their wording, they're really quite weak resolutions, and I think are largely symbolic in nature. But I think it's important to note that that does not vitiate their importance, because I think one cannot underestimate the psychological value of these kind of resolutions by sending the message to Tehran that the UN, that the countries that have supported Iran in the past, Russia and China, have signed on to these resolutions and may sign on to future resolutions. It creates, it revives fears that date back to the Iran-Iraq war, when Iran had to face Iraq alone, did not have any superpower patron, was isolated, did not have any source of arms supply. And I think this strikes at deep-seated fears. And therefore, the importance of even symbolic sanctions at the UN cannot be underestimated. And therefore, I think it's important that we continue with this track. The track that we are now focusing on with the EU countries, trying to create a, trying to put together sanctions of the willing that might entail restrictions on investment in the oil industry and the like, are actually where I think we are hoping that, our hope there is that these will actually be sanctions that have teeth and that bite. And again, for that reason, that's also important. It's important that sanctions, that at least some package of sanctions, have substantial effects, substantive effects on the Iranian economy. The question is whether you can actually put together, people sometimes talk about the possibility of a ban on refined oil products on Iran, because the Iranian economy is highly dependent. I don't remember whether it's about 50% or it's a very significant portion of the refined oil products in Iran are imported. And the question is whether you can do this, whether you can put together an effective sanctions package on refined products outside of the UN framework. And I think that remains a question. And then finally, there's bilateral efforts, especially the efforts by the U.S. Treasury Department to convince banks to stop doing business in Iran and to convince companies that Iran is not a place where it is safe to do business because of a potential for political instability or crisis or war in the future. But in terms of the effects of our sanctions, our sanction track, I would say the verdict is still out. I think there are some important indications that the sanctions have been prompting a debate and have been prompting a backlash against the policies of President Ahmadinejad. The bottom line, though, until they produce a policy outcome that we're looking for, in the end, it's only in the realm of potential that we're talking about. And again, I suspect what we're looking for is Iranian agreement to implement Resolution 1696, which calls for a suspension of enrichment and reprocessing-related activities. And we're not there yet. It's not clear we will get there yet, which raises the question, how do you know when your sanctions track has run its course? And I think the answer to that is it never really does, unless you are willing to take military action and engage in preventive military action. And unless that's the case, then there will always be new horizons to be, or new fields to be tilled. And, you know, there's probably a lot that we haven't done outside of working with European countries. I mean, in South Asia, Southeast Asia, in South America, trying to convince countries there that do business with Iran to cease and desist. So I think the sanction track could continue going on for quite a while, again, unless we or Israel decide to take preventive military action. And again, I think that decision will be influenced at least in part by the perception of, I mean, first of all, the question of will, whether there is the political will to do that. And two, whether when the clock is running out on the window for action. And that raises the question is, you know, what is the red line for preventive military action? Is it mastery, if you will, of the centrifuge technology so that even low-enriched uranium can be produced in a relatively effective way? Or is it when they actually start producing highly enriched uranium? And again, I don't know. There's been claims that there are differences between the U.S. and Israel on this issue. What's, you know, the red line? I don't know where the truth lays on that matter, and I'm not sure we're ready, the United States at least, is ready to go down that path. Now, with regard to the issue of prevention and deterrence, these two policy options are often discussed as if they are kind of mutually exclusive choices, that you either choose a policy of prevention or a policy of deterrence. My feeling is that actually that's that miscasts the debate or the question, because I think most people would agree that if the United States or Israel were to engage in preventive action against Iran's nuclear program, it's likely that Iran at the end would still try to reconstitute its program and go forward in the future. So actually that raises the question, if in the end of the day what you're in the business of deterrence anyhow in the end, what impact does preventive action have on your ability to deter a nuclear Iran down the road? Does preventive action make for a less robust or a more robust deterrence regime? And I don't have the answer to that. That might be something that we want to discuss. But clearly, you know, if you believe that Iran will continue down the nuclear path, or if you believe that, you know, we don't have sufficient knowledge, perhaps, to hit a clandestine nuclear program if it exists, and that we will only hit the overt program and that it will continue with that clandestine program, in the end of the day, you're still in the deterrence business, and you have to consider what impact does prevention have on deterrence. Now, also when considering deterrence and prevention and deterrence, I think in all my years as an analyst, this has been the most complex calculus that I've ever had to, you know, at least in my own thinking, conduct. How does one conduct a comparative risk-benefit assessment of prevention versus deterrence given the uncertainties involved in each case pertaining to risks, to risk, and to the prospects of success? Prevention entails the acceptance of significant near-term risk for an uncertain outcome, because you don't know if you're going to succeed in delaying the program, whose benefits are likely to be short-lived, because again, maybe you put back the program a year, 2 years, 3 years, maybe not at all if there is a clandestine parallel program we don't know about. And other risks include the near certainty of a significant expansion of the war on terror, the likelihood that hundreds of U.S. civilians and military personnel, and perhaps many more, will die in revenge terror attacks, and the possibility of a disruption of oil shipments from the Gulf. Deterrence, on the other hand, entails deferred risk for an uncertain outcome, because you don't know if deterrence will work, and entails the possibility of catastrophic failure. Now, to go into a little more detail, the risks include the possibility that Iran will not be dissuaded from sharing nuclear technology with others, the possibility that its nuclear activities will spur a nuclear arms race in the region, and the possibility that efforts to deter Iran from using the bomb will fail, leading to the deaths of tens or hundreds of thousands of people, if not more. Now, let me just go back and look in a little more detail on the particular challenges of preventive action and deterrence. First of all, the sine qua non of effective preventive action is comprehensive and detailed and accurate targeting intelligence. If you don't know what to hit and where to hit, there's no point in going down, taking this course of action. There's no point in launching a strike. Now, without having access to the classified information, I cannot say whether this prerequisite for military action is met. Looking at our track record with regard to WD intelligence, you know, one is not filled with a great deal of confidence. We all know of the recent intelligence failures with regard to Iraq, Iran, and perhaps North Korea. On the other hand, to be fair, one has to say that, you know, looking back, actually the intelligence community has a mixed record when it comes to WMD intelligence. We've had some successes with Libya, with North Korea. We don't know whether we have the intelligence, and B, even looking at the track record over the past 15 years or so, it's a mixed record, to be fair. And we also have to recognize that the intelligence picture could change very quickly as a result of a walk-in or as a result of, some chance of event or a breakthrough in our intelligence efforts. There's also the question of how time affects our prospects for success. Is it working for or against us? Now, with regard to the intelligence picture, is our intelligence picture getting better or worse with time, with the passage of time? And again, I don't know. Clearly, the IAEA was a major source of information with regard to Iran's nuclear program. They don't have the access they used to have. The issue of facilities. Some facilities are completely built, such as the conversion facility at Isfahan. Others are only in the early stages of construction. So the optimum timing for a strike may not be yet, and it might be better to wait until. For some facilities, it's probably better actually that we would have hit them already, such as the centrifuge production plants, because they're up and producing components already. Other facilities, such as Natanz, if we hit it now, we're still hitting a facility which is still in its early phases of operation, and you won't achieve the maximum benefit. So the problem is there is no optimal time from the point of view, perhaps, of intelligence, the intelligence picture, or in terms of having the maximum effect of disrupting Iran's program, because different parts of the program are in different phases in terms of their development and maturity. Then the issue of weaponeering. Do we have the ability to hit buried and hardened facilities? And I will just say again, there's been, I think, a lot of public discussion which is perhaps off point. People saying that you have to rely on nuclear weapons to destroy Natanz because of its depth and the thickness of the concrete. And the bottom line is we don't know, because there's a lot of variables that come into play in trying to destroy buried and hardened facilities that we just don't know in the open sources. And also, I would mention that we are working now on a piece of ordnance, the Massive Ordnance Penetrator, which is a 28,000-pound penetrator, which is five times larger than any penetrator that we have now in the system. And we don't know what the capabilities of this ordnance is, but I would suspect that even Natanz, which is 75 feet below ground, is vulnerable. And let me just say, without going into details, that the only way to physically destroying such a facility is not the only way to put it out of action. So we might actually have an option to destroy. Okay, I'm not saying we should or we shouldn't. I'm just putting that on the table. And then there's the politics of prevention, which in Washington right now are very complicated. We know from our past precedent that for major military actions, the president has generally sought a congressional resolution of support. Under current conditions, I don't think that would happen, which raises the question of would the administration act unilaterally, or would they consult beforehand with a small select group of congressmen? The bottom line is, any kind of military action against Iran would probably set in train, would be the first phase of a protracted conflict with Iran, and you need to have the support of the American people and public behind such an action. And under the current conditions, I don't think that is forthcoming. And that puts constraints, I think, on the administration's actions. With regard to deterrence, and I talked too long about prevention, but I'll wrap it up now just with a few short comments with regard to the challenges of deterrence. You know, there used to be a debate that, well, nuclear weapons, you know, what in terms of the impact of nuclear weapons possession on the behavior of states, there used to be a debate between those who believe that nuclear weapons induce prudence and caution and those who believe that nuclear weapons induce risk-taking and aggressive behavior. Without going into the details, I would say that looking at the impact that Iran's growing self-confidence as a result of America's problems in Iraq, high oil prices, and their ability to move forward with their nuclear program unfettered has had, I would argue that I think the verdict may be in that, you know, if this is how they're acting, you know, in response to regional geographic developments in their favor, well, what impact would the possession of nuclear weapons have on their self-confidence? And I think we're likely to see an Iran which is more assertive, at the very least, if they were to acquire nuclear weapons. Now, how much of the current behavior is due to the particular, you know, constellation of forces in Iran, and could that change in the future? Maybe we could talk about that in the discussion afterwards. But the bottom line is, I think, in terms of the current regional environment, is that because of recent events in the region, the U.S. you know, the U.S. problems in Iraq, last summer's war in Lebanon, which have, I think, both undermined American and Israeli deterrent, America and Israel's deterrence image in the region, and Iranian self-assertiveness, I think, if this state of affairs continues for the next few years, I think this will be a very dangerous set of circumstances for Iran to emerge as a nuclear power, which could create the objective conditions for a miscalculation, down the road. My final point, and I'll cut things short here, but my final point has to do with, again, creating a deterrence or security regime in the Gulf to deal with perhaps a more assertive Iran that is emboldened by its nuclear potential. And clearly, the prerequisites of, I think, a successful deterrence regime in the Gulf is having the ability to deter by both denial as well as by punishment. Deterrence by denial means having in place the means to neutralize Iran's delivery systems, such as missiles, and that would, the implication for that is robust missile defenses in the region. Having in place the means to deal with non-traditional delivery means, such as boats or unmanned aerial vehicles. In boats, you want to have some kind of maritime cooperation regime in the Gulf with our allies, as well as port security arrangements and the like. And a lot of this is being worked on, actually, with regard to smuggling and the war on terror, but I think it could be used, it could be built on and redirected to deal with the potential threat of non-traditional delivery of nuclear weapons by Iran. And then you also have building up the capability of our own capabilities and the capabilities of our allies in the region to deal with Iran's sea denial capability, to counter Iran's naval special warfare capabilities, their small boat capabilities, their submarine fleet, their ability, their mine warfare capabilities, I think I said that already, and then their anti-ship missile capabilities. And that the implication for that is we need to build up selectively the capabilities of our allies in the region so that they can counter those specific Iranian capabilities. And finally, deterrence by punishment. There are basically three main target sets that we have to develop an ability to be able to strike. Economic targets in Iran, and really this is very easy because it's really comes down to their oil industry, which is exposed. It's largely in the southwest part of the country and in the Gulf. Very easy targets to hit, very soft targets. Leadership. This is an area where actually we've been found wanting in recent years. We have, at the beginning of the war against Iraq, we tried to take out Saddam Hussein without success, and according to a Human Rights Report, Human Rights Watch report on this subject, I think about 50 or 60 attempts at going after leadership targets in Iraq failed, all of them. We didn't see Ali Hassan al-Majid we went after, Saddam Hussein multiple times, and other senior regime officials, and according to the Human Rights Watch report, we didn't hit one. This is one area we need to do better, and this is important in terms of our deterrence capability. And then finally, regime command and control, being able to go after the Revolutionary Guard Corps, besiege units, and the like. And the problem is, going after these units in Iran is different than going after the Republican Guard in Iraq, because the Republican Guard was a large, heavy unit geographically concentrated in the Baghdad area with well-known garrisons, whereas the Rev Guard and the besieged are lightly armed units which are dispersed throughout the country, much more decentralized structure, much more difficult target to hit. So we have, in some areas, I think we have a very robust capability in terms of our ability to, you know, deter or present a strong deterrence posture vis-a-vis Iran, especially by our ability to deter by denial. Our ability to deter by punishment, I think we need to, there's some areas that we still need to do some work. The bottom line is, and my final comment is this, is that I think this assessment of the uncertainties, risks, and challenges of both prevention and deterrence only underscores the importance of pursuing a diplomatic solution to the problem, a solution which I'm not sure we will get. But again, I think if we don't succeed with our diplomatic efforts right now, we'll be facing, I think Iran could pose one of the most difficult challenges we'll be facing in the foreseeable future, not just in the Middle East, but I think beyond. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's it's an awful lot to think about. As we go to questions, if I could ask, A, that you identify yourself, B, because we have a lot of people that everybody just ask one question, and C, that you ask your question in the form of a question, which is to actually have a question and not a statement followed by what do you think. In order to demonstrate that, let me ask a question. One of the things that struck me is the question of how conflict-averse is Iran. And on the one hand, Iran doesn't seem to have any problems sort of with little skirmishes. But one of the things that I don't have a sense for, and I think it goes directly to your two presentations, is how much is Iran really concerned about the possibility of miscalculation turning into war? And therefore, how deterrable are they by a sense that the U.S. is willing to take military action? Or is there a sort of confidence that the strategies that Fred pointed out are strategies that can defend the regime, that these guys can take it, and it's actually the U.S. which is deeply bogged down in Iraq and has no interest in getting bogged down in Iran, and therefore that because the U.S. doesn't really have a trigger, they are safe moving forward however they want to move forward?
So I'll take a stab at that. You know, this, I think this sort of speaks to the debate in analytical circles about Iran as a normal state. You know, does it subscribe to the rules of state behavior? And I just want to to sort of caveat this with that I sort of reject the idea that Iran's ideology, you know, makes it sort of immune to these rules. However, in terms of its ability to miscalculate its escalatory behavior, its misperception of external threats, I really think you have to look at factional politics inside Iran and the fact that foreign policy behavior is a tool for certain foreign policy factions, and that this can get out of control. Even if a particular stance or posture is not in the interest of the state, and even if it risks bringing the threat of some sort of action, the question is how responsive are Iran's leaders to that? And Mike Eisenstadt actually alluded to this in a great article he published in Survival a while ago, Living with a Nuclear Iran. I remember reading it distinctly, and it's this idea, you know, could we have a deterrence relationship with Iran, given the intensely factional nature of the state and this fact that it can lead to escalatory and unpredictable behavior? Now, I think in recent months, I remember seeing quite a lot of press reporting that there's growing opposition to Ahmadinejad among his own allies in parliament, that he is not taking the threat from the U.S. seriously, that his bellicose posturing is isolating Iran, and that he's miscalculating, he's not taking the threat seriously. So there are, I think, voices that do have this sort of state-centric self-survival interest at heart, and it's simply, I think, the larger question is, you know, identifying those and somehow reaching those. So,
yeah, look, we have actually, I guess, until just the last couple of years, we had, which I think in the last couple of years things got a little more murky with the rise of Ahmadinejad and his faction. Clearly during the 90s, we saw clear evidence that Iran was acted in a risk-averse manner. I think largely as a result of the war weariness induced by the Iran-Iraq war and the effect of the bloodletting caused by the revolution. Their behavior during the uprising in 91 in Iraq, where they really avoid intervention on behalf of another Shiite population for fear of perhaps getting dragged into a conflict with the U.S. Likewise, in Afghanistan in 1998, when nine Iranian diplomats were killed by the Taliban, and the Hazaras were being massacred. So that clearly, I think, is still an operative factor in Iranian decision making. And watching what happened to the U.S. in Iraq, I think they've also, from as a result of their own experience and watching the experience of others, they recognize how, you know, how hard it is sometimes to stop a war once you get involved in it and to turn things off. That being said, Ahmadinejad, again, it's very hard to, read him from having never met him and, not knowing him and watching from 7,000 miles away. But my sense is that, he might welcome a limited conflict with, say, the United States for reasons of consolidating his power base and maybe also believing that this might be a way to kind of reinvigorate the revolutionary values of Iranian society. But I think in this, he's probably a distinct minority, and we've already seen signs of, there's been commentary in various newspapers as well as a statement recently by the Supreme Leader and Rafsanjani and others saying, we've got to be careful. And that, actually that Ahmadinejad's policies have exposed us to risk that is unnecessary and perhaps poses dangers to the Islamic Republic. And then finally, the bottom line is this. I mean, in looking at the behavior of the regime and looking at the role of ideology and state interest, I mean, ever since, Khomeini in the late 80s, it's very clear that state interest trumps ideology. For the majority of people in the regime, and that you can't have an Islamic revolution around the world unless you have an Islamic republic, and therefore the survival of the regime is critical to achieving the broader goals of the people who are hold the levers of power in the regime. So they have no desire to lose their privileged position in most cases, or to see the regime endangered. So by and large, I think most of the people are risk averse, and we're seeing a tug of war now between those between those different factions in Iran.
You don't think the Islamic Republic of Mauritania is going to be the gravity and center of an Islamic revolution around the world? Okay. Simon, and then Barbara, and then Dave.
That one. Okay, right, I'm there. Simon Henderson, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. It seems to me that, I mean, what you're essentially arguing, both arguing, is we'll try deterrence, and if deterrence doesn't work, we try sanctions, and if sanctions doesn't work, we've got deterrence. But it seems to me that if and when Iran explodes a nuclear bomb, sanctions will have been proved not to work, and indeed deterrence will have been proved not to work either, because it's not as if the deterrence isn't already out there now. And an indication of this is the bits of reporting which suggest that if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt will also decide to go down that route as well, which is a vote against the deterrence, the friendship of the deterrence provided from a friendship with the United States. Once again, both policies have failed completely. And so in raising the possible options we have available, I would argue that allowing Iran to get there to the bomb is not tenable. And the logic is we have to stop it, which isn't to say I write op-eds on a regular basis saying bomb Iran today or tomorrow. But that's, please, can you please respond to that logic?
Yeah, my sense, you raised the issue of other states pursuing their own nuclear capabilities. And I mean, my sense, we did interviews in the region precisely on this issue. You know, if envisioning the regional landscape, if Iran gets a weapon, and my sense from the region is that they still, you know, hold out the hope for deterrence. That deterrence has not failed, even if Iran gets a bomb. That its behavior can be moderated. I mean, many of our regional allies could live with it. And they could live with it through the sorts of guarantees that Mike was alluding to, extended deterrence, a nuclear umbrella, you know, along the lines of engaging Iran. This is the argument from the region. The idea of showing Iran that it has this new capability that is ultimately a very inflexible diplomatic tool for accomplishing precisely the type of influence it's trying to achieve. And so if Iran's goal is increased prestige and influence by getting this capability, the view from the region is, you know, showing it, you know, you're not going to get anywhere with this. And certainly I think, echoing Mike, I think you would see a period of triumphalism, of jingoism, of Iran throwing its weight around. But you might see a gradual retraction, you know, once Iran realizes that this is not a good vector for asserting itself, you know, you would sort of walk back. So sort of changing Iran's strategic calculus about what this weapon will get. That's the argument, for I think, that I'm hearing in the region. And I don't think the pursuit, you know, Saudi Arabia or Turkey's pursuit of a nuclear capability should be taken, you know, as a given. I mean, there's certain, I think, measures to dissuade them from that, and I think that's another topic for discussion. So.
Let's try to get another invitation back.
Actually, you know, with the issue of sanctions, in a way, you always, like I said, you always have sanctions because right now our sanctions are directed towards trying to bring about a decision to suspend. Okay, but we know that with other countries, even after they've crossed the nuclear threshold, then you want to limit their ability to develop more advanced capabilities, more advanced warhead designs and the like. And you also had, you know, look, we had Pressler Amendment, you know, with Pakistan in the mid-80s. And, you know, so I think sanctions will always, you know, even under, even if, you know, and I hope, you know, I hope we don't get there, but even if we move into a situation where it is likely that Iran has a nuclear, you know, capability or at least an option, sanctions will still be an important part of American policy to slow the development and the progress or the expansion of a potential arsenal. So I think sanctions always remain on the table. It's just a matter of, you know, redefining the goals that you're trying to accomplish with them. Likewise with deterrence, I mean, you know, to be honest with you, the whole issue of deterrence is much more complicated than can be dealt with in a short presentation because there's the issue of what you're trying to deter. Are you trying to deter, first of all, them, acquiring the capability to develop nuclear weapons? Are you trying to deter them from testing? Are you trying to deter them from transferring either technology or finished, or fissile material or a finished weapon? Are you trying to deter them from engaging in conventional or unconventional, I mean, like, you know, acts of terrorism, guerrilla warfare under the nuclear umbrella? And it's very complicated, but I suspect our ability to deter some of those things is better than our ability to deter others. And we may not, and again, I hope we don't get there, we may not succeed in deterring them from acquiring the capability for an option or the capability to build a bomb, but we may succeed in at least some of those other secondary goals. Although, as I said before in my presentation, I tend to be rather, I won't say pessimistic, but less sanguine than a lot of people that this is a manageable problem. I tend to be a pessimist in this matter. But it's a much more complicated issue than, you know, deterring them from, you know, just acquiring.
Yeah. And so what you're both saying is that you think the NPT regime can survive an Iranian nuclear weapon?
I don't know if it can survive, but it's a tool that we have to use because it's the source of our, right now, international legitimacy for what we're trying to convince other people to do. So, I mean, why not use it? You know, although it's, you know, recent steps by, you know, Mohammed al-Barde, such as the understanding between Iran and the IAEA, are, you know, raises questions about, you know, the, you know, what's happening at the IAEA and their resolve, which is important to stand up for, you know, the treaty that they are, you know, charged with. I won't say not enforcing, but monitoring, if you will. And so,
Barbara.
Barbara Slavin from the U.S. Institute of Peace. First time I get to say that. I want to ask about the impact of all of this on the domestic scene. Mike, you alluded to it a little bit, and I think you're a pretty good analyst, even though you've never met Ahmadinejad. Iran has elections coming up, parliamentary in March 2008, presidential the following year. As Mr. Wary pointed out, Ahmadinejad is not terribly popular these days. They have a lot of economic problems. Two things just mentioned. Khamenei came out yesterday and said it was okay to criticize political leaders this after Ahmadinejad got yelled at the university. And also Hassan Rouhani is reemerging, the former national security advisor, also criticizing Ahmadinejad, which are interesting signals. How does all of this, the sanctions, the threat of war, play out in terms of Iranian domestic politics? What are the dangers that an American attack would set back the chances that Ahmadinejad would be history come 2009 and that Iran's political system might self-correct, as it has done so many times, and move back toward more pragmatic and more reformist factions? How do you factor that into your calculation? And what about negotiations? Neither of you talked about sitting down and negotiating with them, dropping the preconditions, and trying to begin a process like the ones the Iranians proposed in 2003. Is it too late for that? Is it too late for that with this administration? I mean, one can keep the sanctions and also talk to them, yes?
Yeah. You want to start with
that? No, go ahead.
Okay. I should have been more assertive with those and give this one to him. But with the issue of bombing, you know, to be honest with you, I mean, the boilerplate response is that there'll inevitably be a nationalist backlash and a rally around the flag effect. The bottom line is, I think things are actually, you know, usually much more complicated than this. And I think part of it depends. You know, I think inevitably there would be some kind of nationalist backlash, although I'm not sure it would necessarily translate to votes for Ahmadinejad, because his opponents, it depends, first of all, how skillfully his opponents, you know, say, well, you know, this is, you know, my opponent, you know, it's my opponent's fault that we, you know, that we are where we are. It also depends on how many civilians are, you know, killed in such an action. If it's a relatively, you know, surgical, you know, strike, and these things never are completely surgical, but that might have an effect. It depends how expansive the operation is. If we, you know, if we also hit military targets, and if we restrict it just to Quds forces and besiege and maybe instruments of domestic repression, people might have a different attitude towards it than if it's a more wide-ranging operation that hits regular, you know, regular military, where a lot, you know, facilities where a lot of conscripts get killed. So I think there's probably a lot of unknowns and a lot of variables which make, you know, kind of predicting how, you know, the political outcome of a military strike, you know, impossible. Although you could probably, you could at least define, you know, what impact things might have. But I, you know, I don't know, you know, there's that, you know, Hirsch article saying, you know, it would be much more, you know, any U.S. strike now would be much more narrowly focused. I always take his, you know, his writings with a grain of salt. And, you know, but it's out there and a lot of people talk about it. So I raise it. Anyhow, I'll leave the, in terms of negotiations, I have, by the way, I'm not averse to negotiations, you know, myself, and I think the idea, at least in my mind, is that sanctions would get us to a point where we could negotiate then from a more favorable position, and, you know, address, you know, I think it might be more too difficult just to, you know, to look for a global, you know, settlement at this point, and and as a result, it might be better to focus more narrowly, but domestically, politically, it might be very difficult in the United States to sell, you know, kind of a just negotiation on a nuclear issue when American troops are being killed by Iranians in Iraq, and how can we negotiate with these people while they're killing our troops in Iraq? And this is always a conundrum we have. You know, a narrowly focused negotiations have a greater chance of succeeding. In theory, but politically, it's much more difficult to sell. And global settlement is so complicated. Your book probably is devoted almost completely to this. So I don't need to, expand on this really, but.
Yeah, I would just echo this on the impact of strikes in terms of mobilizing, popular support around Ahmadinejad. I mean, that's sort of the standard line. He's a bad guy, but at least he's our bad guy. I think there could be a lot of unknowns. I mean, revolutions have occurred during wars. I mean, think about the Russian Revolution. I do think in terms of pressuring Iran, labeling the Revolutionary Guard a terrorist organization, the increased pressure. I mean, we're seeing signs that is empowering repressive security institutions with this so-called clampdown on the Velvet Revolution. It is feeding into paranoia. It's allowing the regime to say to the people, see, we told you so. I think that's having a detrimental impact on the voices that we would like to encourage. Also another issue of, Mike mentioned targeting the Revolutionary Guard in terms of its difficulty because it's dispersed. Another issue is its sources of legitimacy inside Iranian society. We just don't know enough about how it has interwoven itself into sort of the nationalist narrative of Iranian political life, the fact that it certainly has mafioso tendencies and it's antagonized certain economic interests and merchant classes, but at the same time, it's pervasive, and the idea that you can somehow disaggregate this institution and portray it as sort of the root of evil in Iran, I think is unrealistic. Regarding this potential swing in Iranian politics toward these pragmatic conservatives, I mean Rouhani, his ascendancy is potentially welcoming. I mean there's a great quote by him that says the issue of relations with the U.S. Or the opening of relations with the U.S. is inevitable. The great test of our skill will be opening those relations at a time of our choosing. So it's based on this argument that people like Ray Tekke have said, the pragmatic conservatives have the capability and the credentials to deliver the grand bargain to the U.S. I think I'm not very optimistic about a grand bargain emerging anytime soon because it's sort of sweeps under the table a whole history of mistrust, and it assumes a sort of horse trading mentality that on the part of the Iranians that I don't think is there. Nonetheless, I mean the ascendancy of some of these other people is encouraging. I mean someone I would watch is Qalibaf, former mayor of Tehran or current mayor, I'm sorry, and former law enforcement forces commander, a strong presidential contender in the last one. Revolutionary Guard credentials, but apparently more pragmatic, I guess, if we can use that term. So,
can I just add two quick things?
Yeah.
With regard to the Revolutionary Guard forces, it's been a while since I looked at this, but my understanding is that in the course of the 90s, the Rev Guard became very much a conscript type organization and lost a lot of its kind of revolutionary, zeal and status, and that it used to be that they would do all kinds of vetting for people who were considered for the IRGC during the Iran-Iraq War, and after the war, it became more as just kind of except for maybe Quds Force and the like, it became just a conscript force that mirrored the population at large, and people often discuss, the elections in 97 for Khatami, that in that neighborhood, in the neighborhood that was the Rev Guard, where they had the residential section for the Rev Guard, he polled exactly the same as or more, maybe just one or two points more than the rest of the general population.
73%.
Okay, that was 1 or 2 points more than the rest of the population. So, I haven't seen anything to indicate that that's changed since then. So we have to be very careful, that I think in a lot of ways, much of the Rev Guard is probably reflects, is a lot closer to the regular army in a lot of ways. Not maybe the senior ranks, but at least the rank and file. The second issue, and I just want to raise a point, and I'm not quite sure how it plays out in this case, but again, people often talk about the impact of bombings on civilian populations, and let me make it clear, we're not going to be targeting if we were to go down this route, we're not going to be targeting civilian populations, but the impact of bombings is to create a backlash and cause people to only stiffen their resolve. And I once actually looked at the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey that was done during World War II. They have a section actually on impact of bombing on morale. And keep in mind, the bombing campaigns in Europe and Japan, in Europe, it was kind of, under the rubric of dehousing the industrial population. They targeted, in Germany, large civilian population centers were targeted. And both, I think, in the Japanese and the German the volumes looking at the impact of bombings on the Japanese and German population, they indicated that the bombing had a profoundly demoralizing impact on the population and did cause an anti-regime backlash. The problem was they were not organized, and there was no vehicle by which the frustration or anger of the population could be focused. So, and that's an important thing, because it's often mischaracterized. And the thing is, people often give the example of the Blitz in London, that it stiffened, the English upper lip. And again, to my knowledge, I don't know if there's been a survey was ever done of the British population, but clearly we have two very good studies done of the German and Japanese populations. Again, this is a case that's different, where the population was intentionally targeted, and it did result in a profound effect on morale, but with no political implications.
Yeah, that was in the context of total World War II.
I said I am not sure this has application to this case, but I'm just saying it. People often, it's one of the few data points we have on this kind of phenomenon. So I agree with you. It doesn't. It maybe has limited applicability.
Dave. Thank you. Dave Pollack from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. I want to ask about the Arab reaction to all of this, which Fred Wary raised. In this way, people often talk about, and I think you did, about the divide between the governments and the publics. I don't see it. I see no evidence of that whatsoever, especially lately. I've looked very hard at this using whatever anecdotal and polling evidence I can find. And since the blip caused by the Israel-Lebanon war in 2006, I see nothing but a return to the usual Arab, and I'm talking about at the popular level, suspicion. Mm-hmm. Distrust, even hostility toward Iran. And I don't see that Arab governments face any potential popular obstacles in that respect. That's one point. The other point has to do with you said that Arab governments are divided on this, now switching to the governments. Mm-hmm. I don't really see that either. I see that they're not coordinated, they're not united, but if what you meant was that they're actively divided, that they have conflicting agendas about how to deal with Iran, except for Syria, I don't see that either. So I just like some.
Yeah, no, I mean the sort of crescendo of popular acclaim for Ahmadinejad and Iran because of the 2006 war has definitely slid back down with the Saddam hanging, undisputably. There was a slight increase. I mean, based on a lot of poll, we've looked at the polling too. NavCent has done some interesting analysis of very rigorous content analysis of themes in the pan-Arab media looking at the Gulf. There was an increase in support for Iran when they released the hostages or the British sailors that they took. Iran was believed to be magnanimous. I think on the big divide, I think this is borne out by polling, is on the nuclear issue. There is popular sort of endorsement for Iran's right to nuclear energy, not necessarily because the publics think that it's a good idea for Iran to have a bomb or a nuclear capability, but because it's sort of an indirect critique against Western interference, against Western double standards. And I think that's a real, that's borne out, I think, by the polling. So that's a key.
Nuclear energy.
Yeah. I mean, it's still the Well, I mean, but it's a difference from the regime's position. I mean,
the regime's that is the Arab regime's position, that Iran has the right to a peaceful nuclear program. That's the GCC position.
And but there's tremendous distrust over the intentions.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and
I
yeah.
think that distrust exists at popular
level. Yeah, I think it's a little more. I see your point. I mean, I just see more. Anyway, the issue of the divide, as I characterize it, I think it is, you know, differing threat perceptions about what constitutes the greatest threat. And this is borne out, I think, from our interviews that we did in the Gulf. Tremendous divergence, for instance, on the part of Oman, from, say, the UAE, from, say, Kuwait. There's also a sense in the Gulf that Cairo is not taking the threat seriously from Iran because of its distance from Iran. So these are divergences. And, you know, I mean, you look at the Kuwaitis. They're concerned principally about the environmental impact. They've always viewed Iraq more as a threat. The Omanis down at the other end have been very accommodationist toward Iran. I just wanted to sort of capture in my comments that a lot of times when you're listening to Arab debates and deliberations on Iran, it's not so much about Iran itself, but it's a debate about regional order. And in many cases, I think some of the smaller Gulf states are more worried about the ascendancy of Saudi Arabia as sort of a new, almost policeman of the Gulf, that Saudi Arabia is using the pretext, Iranian ascendancy as a pretext to reassert itself over the Gulf, and that the U.S. will tacitly endorse this. So this was really borne out to
like
us.
A guttery view.
A guttery view, Omani view, that the result will be that these smaller Gulf states, their own bilateral relations with Washington will suffer. So,
I mean, you had a question. Can we do it quickly? Because we're coming up very close to two.
I'll actually have a question. Amin Tazi from U.S. Marine Corps University. Mike, you ended, first of all, good to see you. You ended about saying, you know, that you still may, you know, pessimistically, but believe in negotiations. Having been involved in even that so-called Grand Bargain, which was in 2003, and being, you know, meeting Iranians for 5 years, and today's situation, from the U.S. perspective, you know, Ahmadinejad says that there are three powers in the region, Israel, Iran, and the Americans. The Americans will leave because they're from outside. Israel will be wiped out by elections, and Iran is going to be the country. Totally ignoring the rest of the region, whether it's Turkey, Saudis, or even the smaller Gulf states. They want that region. We are there. So right now, their main interest and our presence is in direct conflict. And secondly, looking at the past, it doesn't have to be with our situation right now and their Ahmadinejad. Even the past, when we talk about the good old days, we talked at each other. We never really understood each other, nor we accepted each other's priorities. What are the basis of some concrete basis of negotiations that we on our side can give or they can give, even if it is dreamlike? But what are a few things that we can do so we can be kind of a live and let live situation for, say, foreseeable future?
Feel free to take a full minute to remaining to answer the question.
Yeah, I don't even know where to start with. There's a full-time industry in Washington devoted to, you know, how to get to yes, you know, with Iran, and I don't think I could really offer, you know, anything really that hasn't been said, you know, already. I mean, I think there's a recognition that we do have shared interests in some areas, and that we do have conflicting interests in others, and it would be desirable if we could handle these differences as well as commonalities, like in a more normal way, in the way that, you know, that other countries do, without worrying about the possibility of a war, you know, resulting from our conflict of interest. So I guess that's the fundamental, you know, interest driving, you know, and also to get, you know, Iran out of the business of doing things which, you know, potentially could destabilize the region, you know, proliferation that could have second and third order effects, never mind to leading potentially to a war. I'm not sure, you know, certainly if Iran would stop, you know, their provision of support for militias in Iraq and support for Hamas in the Palestinian areas, it would improve the situation there. I don't think it would solve, you know, help us necessarily solve the problems in both places, but certainly it would make the problems more manageable. So I'm not quite sure if that. I mean,
what would bring? What would they do? For example, you mentioned that. What would bring United States on the table? Not a nuclear issue, but something tangible that they can actually do. That would
stop providing EFPs and arms to the special, you know, special cells in Iraq. Is, I think, given the focus that the administration has been putting on this recently, I think that's very easy, and that's something which, you know, it's not clear to me in the long run. You know, what kind of benefits Iran gets out of that, because it empowers people that might, in the end, might be difficult for them to control if they were to come into power in Baghdad. So, you know, I'll just leave it at that.
Well said.
This is, I think, been a remarkably rich and thought-provoking discussion. It's going to take me a while to digest all of this. Hopefully lunch will be digested sooner. Thank you very much for coming, and we look forward to seeing you at our next event. Thank you.